Chapter 1. A Crash Landing. Jarvis stretched himself so that he was almost comfortable in the narrow main room of his spaceship, the Ares. "Air you can breathe," he said happily. "It feels as thick as soup after the thin stuff out there." He nodded at the Martian landscape, stretching flat and empty in the light of the nearer moon, beyond the glass of the port. The other three stared at him sympathetically. They were the German Putz, the engineer, the Frenchman Leroy, the biologist, and the Canadian Harrison, the astronomer and captain of the expedition. The American Dick Jarvis was chemist of the famous crew of the Ares expedition. They were the first human beings to set foot on the mysterious neighbor of the Earth, the planet Mars. This, of course, was in the old days, less than 20 years after the insane American Doheny perfected atomic power at the cost of his life. It was also only a decade after the equally crazy Cardoza used atomic power to travel to the moon. The four members of the Ares expedition were true pioneers. Except for a half dozen moon expeditions and the failed Delancey flight aimed at the fascinating planet of Venus, they were the first men to feel gravity other than Earth's. They were certainly the first successful crew to leave the Earth-Moon system, and they deserved that success. The crew suffered much difficulty and discomfort, spending months in special chambers back on Earth, which helped them learn to breathe the thin air on Mars. They took great risks by traveling to space in a tiny rocket driven by the unreliable reaction motors of the 21st century, but their greatest difficulty was traveling to an absolutely unknown world. Jarvis stretched, touched the raw tip of his injured nose, and sighed again. He felt comfortable. "Well," shouted Harrison abruptly, "are we going to hear what happened? You were fine when you left, then we didn't hear anything from you for 10 days. And finally, Putz here found you in a crazy anthill with a strange ostrich as your friend. Spill it, man!" Jarvis began his story. "According to orders," he said, "I watched Carl here take off toward the north, and then I got into my flying sweat box and headed south. Captain, you'll remember that we had orders not to land, but just scout about for interesting places." I turned on the two cameras and flew along. I flew pretty high, about 2,000 feet, for a couple of reasons. First, it gave a greater view for the cameras. And second, the underjets travel so far in this light air that they stir up dust if you move low.
"We know all that from Putz," said Harrison. "I wish you'd saved the films, though. They'd have paid the cost of this trip. Remember how the public was so interested in the first moon pictures?"
"The films are safe," responded Jarvis. "Well," he resumed, "as I said, I flew along pretty fast. Just as we thought, the wings don't have much lift in this air at less than 100 miles per hour, and even then I had to use the underjets. So the speed and the altitude and the shaking caused by the underjets all made it hard to see, but I could see enough to distinguish that what I sailed over was just more of the gray plain that we'd been examining the whole week since our landing. I could see the same round growths and the same endless carpet of crawling little plant animals, or biopods, as Leroy calls them. So I sailed along, reporting my position every hour as you instructed, but I didn't know whether you heard me."
"I did," snapped Harrison.
Jarvis wasn't bothered. He continued, 150 miles south, the surface changed to a sort of low plateau. There was nothing but desert and orange-colored sand. I thought that our guess was right, that this gray plain we landed on was really the Mare Cimmerium, which would make my orange desert the region called Xanthus. If I were right, I would reach another gray plain, the Mare Cronium, in another couple of 100 miles, then another orange desert, file 1 or 2, and so I did.
"Putz confirmed our position a week and a half ago," said the captain. "Let's get to the point."
"Coming," remarked Jarvis. 20 miles into Thyle, believe it or not, I crossed a canal."
"Putz photographed 100. Let's hear something new."
"And did he also see a city?"
20, if you think those piles of mud are cities."
Well, said Jarvis, from now on I'll be telling you about a few things Putz didn't see. He rubbed his nose and continued, I knew that the day would last for 16 hours at this season, so 8 hours or 800 miles from here, I decided to turn back. I was still over Thyle, whether it was one or two, I'm not sure, but I was more than 25 miles into it, and right there, Putz's favorite motor quit. Quit? How? Putz was anxious to hear. The atomic power got weak. I started losing altitude right away, and suddenly I landed hard right in the middle of Thyle. Smashed my nose on the window, too. He touched his hurt nose sadly.
Did you try washing the power chamber with acid? Inquired Putz. Sometimes the lead gives secondary radiation.
No, said Jarvis in a disgusted voice. I wouldn't try that, of course. Not more than 10 times. Besides, the bump smashed the landing gear and broke off the underjets. Suppose I got the thing working. What then? If I'd traveled 10 miles using main power, the floor would have melted right under me. He rubbed his nose again. Lucky for me, a pound only weighs 7 ounces here, or I'd have been smashed flat.
I could have fixed it, said the engineer. I bet it wasn't serious.
Probably not, agreed Jarvis sarcastically. Only it wouldn't fly. Nothing serious, but I had my choice of waiting to be picked up or trying to walk back 800 miles in perhaps 20 days before we had to leave. 40 miles a day. Well, he concluded, I chose to walk. The same chance of being picked up, and it kept me busy.